Welcome everyone to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are in paper 81, section 5, which is old single column, page 905. Okay, we have a little section here to do before we get into the great big final section of this paper, which we'll be splitting between tonight and next week. This section tees up the final section in many ways. You know, it kind of serves as a preface for this for the big final section, as we'll see when we get into it. They touch on a few things that are picked up in context in the final section. The point of the remaining part of this paper is to get more immediately to the point of the final two words of the title of the paper. You know, it's a little bit about modern civilization. We've gone through all of the precursor issues, and they would like to now give us a final review of the key elements. Now, even more so than the earlier parts of this paper that we've already gone through. Even more so now, with an eye to how this is immediately relevant to now. You know, even less of a historical eye, even if they're speaking of a historical issue. You know, you train your eye to be looking, you know, even more so to you know, the foundational truths that transcend all time, not just past and present time, but all time, that are you know, always completely relevant to be able to sustain and foster the progress of civilization. Okay, so let's get into this section. I'll just, you know, a little comment right up front about the title of the section. You can see they're obviously wanting you to think about the difference between the specific sense of the word society in contrast to the word culture, in contrast to the word civilization. I mean, we're obviously talking about civilization. It's in the title of the paper. But it's clear from the title of the section here that we're not talking about as they're concluding this paper, like I was saying, they're not wanting to focus on the most primitive civilization where you can barely say that you have culture, right? You know, you just have kind of, you know, slightly fancy society. You know, they want to talk about something much more than just the fifth adjutant, the natural consequences of the functioning of the fifth adjutant. You very much have the sixth adjutant in play, so that there is some sort of a spark, you know, as a nucleus, at least a quasi-religious nucleus to this society, you know, which has, you know, a lot of consequences beyond the immediacy of just them having some sort of, you know, evolutionary religion involved in their society. You know, that spark, that impulse is what powers you up into relationship with the seventh adjutant and the Holy Spirit subsequent to that, so that you can have a more human phenomenon in the individuals and hence a more significantly civilized phenomenon in the collective. Okay, so let's see what they say here for us.
Section 5, Cultural Society. Biologic evolution and cultural civilization are not necessarily correlated. Organic evolution in any age may proceed unhindered in the very midst of cultural decadence. But when lengthy periods of human history are surveyed, it will be observed that eventually evolution and culture become related as cause and effect. Evolution may advance in the absence of culture, but cultural civilization does not flourish without an adequate background of antecedent racial progression. Adam and Eve introduced no art of civilization foreign to the progress of human society. But the Adamic blood did augment the inherent ability of the races and did accelerate the pace of economic development and industrial progression. Adam's bestowal improved the brain power of the races, thereby greatly hastening the processes of natural evolution.
Okay, so that paragraph is obviously in the wake of what we just read in the preceding section, where they talked so much about the biologic foundational issues. And, okay, so you have that biologic foundation, but you notice they make a point, you have to remember, you know, that the more appropriate it is to label this societal phenomenon a civilized one, you know, to call it a civilization, the more it hinges upon the unnaturalness of genuine human choice, not just how the mind functions predicated on the biology, you know, naturally. However, there's obviously a relationship. It's all one system in the biggest sense. And as we've talked, you know, brought up many, many times, there's a long span of civilizational development where, when all is said and done, we tend to progress in spite of ourselves. You know, the inexorable biologic evolution means that it may be slow, but the mind that's attuned to that ever-progressing biologic foundation, that mind becomes more and more sophisticated and just naturally manifests a more sophisticated collective phenomenon, you know, associations of individuals. Okay. You know, as is accentuated, like they point out there, Adam and Eve come as biologic uplifters because you can only go so far on a given biologic foundation. No matter how long you let things roll on, if without that biologic uplift, civilization just maxes out. And it will not go up anymore until you bring the biologic foundation up underneath it. And that, as we've pointed out, that's true subsequent to a full Adamic bestowal on a normal world. It's a biologic uplift, but it's not a complete biologic uplift on any world. On a normal world, with everything goes just as it's supposed to with that biologic uplift from Adam and Eve, way down the road, eventually civilization would max out and couldn't go any further, couldn't go any higher without even more improvement in the biologic foundation underneath. And that improvement is done through human effort. Not only to just limit how much minimal genetics there is in any given stock, which obviously drags civilization down. But, more to the immediate point, literal genetic engineering to lift the genetics up even higher than Adam and Eve's infusion does, basically naturally. It's through procreation.
That's helpful.
Right? I mean, no planet can have the kind of civilization of a world enlightened life with just what happens naturally plus what Adam and Eve do. Right? You can't get to that high quality genetics that can support such an advanced civilization. It requires lots of very precise genetic engineering. More and more the planet becomes personality managed, right? And more by the actual persons, right? You become uplifting as a people on a planet, right? Less and less are you looking for some savior to come from on high and fix things for you. It's like, no, we got this. We can do this ourselves. Right now, we all know everyone basically feels utterly inadequate to the challenges at hand and are constantly looking for someone to come from above and fix things for us. Michael, please return, or whatever. That's needed in the early stages, but the farther you get along, more and more the personality management comes from the people native to the planet and not from beings, persons from on high. Right? When you get the mortals of a world able to actually learn the super universe tongue, when you're way enlightened life. Okay, those are beings that are a lot higher than, all of the lower beings on high, right? The on high isn't so high anymore, right? So you've got that, you have that, those biologic issues, but we want to, we don't want to focus on that issue much. It's just here in this first paragraph, they're reminding us of that. They want to most importantly just remind you of the mindal evolution part of this, and hence the cultural or civilizational evolution. When they say there at the end, Adam's bestowal improved the brain power of the races, thereby greatly hastening the process of natural evolution. Right. I mean, in the context of the paragraph, right. I mean, they've shifted gears there. We're talking about the evolution of civilization. Right. That natural evolution. And not focusing so much on what happens kind of, in spite of ourselves because of an evolving biologic predicate. But again, you're not going to have... You get very far with civilization until it becomes quite definitively unnatural, right? Quite definitively a choice. I mean, technically, like I've pointed out, you shouldn't use the word civilization in the absence of choice, right? Society, culture, they just happen naturally. But civilization technically has to be chosen, and it has its ongoingness has to obviously then be chosen. You don't just choose it and start it up, and then magically it just goes on. It has to be rechosen in every moment, forevermore. The moment a world enlightened life stops choosing civilization would be the moment that there was no civilization on that planet. It would disappear in a generation just like it could here now. Right, but they're way too wise, insightful, and foresightful to make such a choice. And the world is enlightened life. Us, on the other hand, okay, this book wouldn't be in my lap if it was a given, right, that we were all going to make these choices, and there wouldn't be an interregnum. You know, there's no, you know, there obviously is a potential for an interregnum. In other words, a ceasing of choosing to uphold civilization. Yep.
Yes, when they talk about the biologic evolution and cultural civilization are not correlated, organic evolution in any age may proceed unhindered in the very midst of cultural decadence. So that's what we have right now. In this world right now, we have cultural decadence. And then it says that cultural civilization does not flourish without an adequate background of antecedent racial progression. So that means that we have not progressed racially yet enough to be able to bring us up. Because right now, to me, it looks like we're going down.
Yeah, and the main thing right now is, I mean, there's not a lot of biologic evolution that, you know, hasn't already manifested in us. You know, we're way down the road from, you know, when the basics of biologic evolution peaked 40,000 years ago, so that Adam and Eve come to uplift at that point, you know, and the biologic evolution subsequent to Adam and Eve are, you know, a lot of it is kind of I-dotting and T-crossing, you know, in the big picture sense. You know, you don't get radical evolutionary progress in a very foundational way subsequent to an Adam and Eve. And so, you know, the big problem, you know, as we know, when you think about what they really make some stark statements throughout the book, is we have a lot of individuals of very limited genetic quality that are dragging us down, and we give them impact on our society more and more and more. So, I mean, one of them, I mean, yeah, it's a problem with those that aren't so lowly genetically are ceasing to choose. That's a problem. We could fix that by choosing otherwise. But there's a lot of people that, you know, they're so marginally human to begin with. If we don't do something about that, you know, you're sealing the fate, the doom of Western civilization. You know, as we saw, where was that? You remember recently we read that, I can't remember exactly where that was, but where they were, you know, pointing out that very starkly, that if you don't control immigration, for instance, right, in a civilized domain, you can kiss your civilization goodbye. Because there's an awful lot of people on the planet that have no ability to self-initialize civilization. They're human. God loves them just as much as anyone else. But okay, that's not the issue. God's love is not the issue. It's civilization that's the issue. And I mean, think about it. You know, the spear point Sangic race, red man. All right, you bring him over to North America 80,000 years ago, and when white man found him, I mean, you think, wow, 80,000 years, he's a very, you know, he's the most progressive Sangic. White man probably found a very advanced civilization on the North American continent, didn't he? No, he found a lot of them, you know, that you couldn't even really call barbarian. They were just savage. Yeah, so see, that's the that's the sort of the leading edge of just a mere evolutionary civilizational potential. I mean, you just can't, you know, you can leave Sangics you know, to evolve civilization for hundreds of thousands of years and basically get nothing. Right? They'll be still making the exact same mud huts that they were 400,000 years prior. So that's why the Revelagers are so stark, even though that's hopelessly politically incorrect to even speak of such things these days. But nonetheless, I mean, that's just the fact. I mean, you don't have to believe that. It's just a simple observational fact. It's obvious that sub-Saharan Africa, before colonization, was not going anywhere fast. Right? And if you take out the colonizers, there's a strong tendency for them to just go right back to where they were before colonization. Because they're just, you know, it's not that they can't be civilized, but they're not going to initiate it. Right? You've got all of those issues, but the thing that the Revelators want to focus on right now is not so much our biologic limitations, or even the degenerate and defective elements, in our genetic stock. They want to hold up what things are essential to civilization so that those who can self-initiate can choose, number one, remember that they have to choose, and two, remember what they have to choose. And you can't just choose any old thing. You have to choose the essentials of civilization. You can't just randomly choose something. And so you need to know what it is that you have to choose, what it is you have to make sure is there if there's any possibility for something to be ongoing. Okay, so that's the main thing they want to stress here, is to try just, for those who want to take delight in cultivating, what it is that you need to have in front of your face, what it is you need to see, recognize, and never turn your eyes from, and make sure that you are firmly focused on those and are passing the truths of those foundational elements of civilization onto your children, onto the next generation, so they can choose likewise. And they hand it on to their children, and on it goes. That's what they want to focus on. Okay, let's see. Was there anything else? I think we probably covered everything there. I think we got it all. Let's keep going.
Through agriculture, animal domestication, and improved architecture, mankind gradually escaped the worst of the incessant struggle to live and began to cast about to find within wherewith to sweeten the process of living. And this was the beginning of the striving for higher and ever higher standards of material comfort. Through manufacture and industry, man is gradually augmenting the pleasure content of mortal life.
Okay, so one other little element. Okay, got the biologic thing. Then they're reminding you of the, of the developmental ethics, for progressing civilization. If anyone, doesn't have it burned in their memory yet, remember you can always go back to section 5 in paper 50. It's entitled Progressive Civilization, and you've got those things that we repeat so often, the nutrition epoch, the security age. Okay, for instance, and obviously the beginning of that paragraph, through agriculture, animal domestication, and improved architecture, right? That whole bit, the incessant struggle to live, right? That's overcoming the issues of the nutrition epoch and the security age, obviously. It should be obvious to you now because we've gone over it so many times. And if it isn't obvious, it becomes immediately obvious when they literally say material comfort, subsequent to that, for the material comfort era. They're just reminding you that that's a very foundational thing that you have to keep in mind. There's nothing automatic about the issues of the nutrition epoch and the security age taking care of themselves, right? You know, so the deeper you get into material comfort and focusing on ever subtler refinements of your pleasure as an individual, if you take the eye off the food ball, you starve to death, right? Or the security ball, yeah, you're killed by benighted hordes, you know, coming from somewhere. So you know, we all know that, you know, especially the security one, we started to get so caught up in the material comfort era, and we started to take security for granted, that things started, there started to be issues. And you can tell there's issues just simply because people started using the word security again more than they used to. No surer sign that there's an issue with something when people just instinctually start talking about that issue. Right? You don't have to go back many years, and no one ever said tribalism, right? And especially in any sort of straightforward public discourse. Now the word tribalism is, you know, is in every other sentence for anyone who's has any eyes open, right? And so you hear the word all the time now. Ah, there's probably an issue there. I'm hearing that word. Yeah. So, right, you've got to make sure that, you know, like when they say agriculture, animal domestication, whatnot. Okay, I mean, got to make sure that the nutrition epic issues are, you know, continue to be taken care of properly. You can't just pretend that you know, farms produce, you know, sufficient product just magically or something, right? You know, and the security things. And then, you know, the whole point, remember, of pushing us ever farther along in the material comfort era, like they're saying there with, you know, through manufacture and industry, right? You augment the pleasure content of material life. But the point is not the ends of the material comfort area is not mere self-gratification. Right? It might appear to be what it's all about, because that's what, you know, everyone just seems to get more and more fixated on themselves and ever, you know, more delightful pleasures of self, but the real point is only to be recognized from above. For the delights of self to produce such grotesque results that people take a hold of more of their human nature, more of their self-awareness, and look down upon what the self is doing, you know, to the ends of self-gratification, and say to that self, you know, this is all wonderful in the moment, but as I look forward to the future, I see issues for myself. This is destructive for me in the long run. And then, you know, you get even higher. Oh, not only is it self-destructive, okay, but I infect society around me. You know, and the whole thing is becoming, the whole society is becoming diseased. It's time to seek something beyond the moment, the delights of the moment. It's time to put my sights to the future more than I ever have. You know, a lot more than I had to, like, to keep from starving to death during the winter or something like that, and I had to think about the future, store up something in my root cellar or whatever. You know, I need to focus on the future very, very definitively and very far-sightedly, and I need to go on a quest for knowledge and wisdom.
Without anxiety.
Yeah, without anxiety.
Use your mind.
Right. Yeah, and that will kind of come naturally. There'll be less anxiety, because the more you get up there, then using your higher mind and having it, you know, really focused on the future, fear and anxiety naturally melt away because they're phenomena of the moment, right? Now, sure, you can use your spiritual consciousness to drag them up out of the moment and stretch them out into horrendous future dread, okay, but nonetheless, right? I mean, if you're...
And you can use it to do the opposite.
Yeah, right. So that obviously the point is, right, you know, we all know the double-edged sword when I start to use my higher abilities, right? But nonetheless, you know, that's the point of that tyranny, intolerance, you know, gluttony, drunkenness, you know, whatnot of the material comfort era is, you know, to finally have stark enough contrasts that you wake up as a human, you know, and see that this is not to our future benefit. This is all wonderful in the moment, but it's very self-absorbed.
In a way, we have to succeed where Adam and Eve failed.
Yes.
Yeah. They were trying to solve future problems, and when they should have been taking care of the current business.
Right, right. Immediate issues needed to be tended to. And instead, see, they were bringing in the dread element. See, they were using their personal nature in that wrong side of the blade way. See,
yeah.
They like we've said so many times, they're looking at, oh, how on earth are we going to solve these problems? And when I think about it over the next 10,000 years, oh my goodness, it's just an insurmountable. You know, it's like, no, focus on tomorrow, Adam and Eve. Okay, right? Just like Jesus, you know, told us, right? Today has enough problems of its own, right? Don't weigh down today with dread about tomorrow. All right. So, yeah, I mean, very well said. You know, it's not just because Adam and Eve dropped the ball, but, you know, kind of why they dropped the ball. We have to do better than Adam and Eve did. We have to be more far-seeing than they were in a positive mode. Right, you could say that, like we were just saying, you could say they were far-seeing, but they were using their far-seeingness in the error and evil detector mode, right? In the negative mode, right? We need to be very far-seeing, and we have to choose to keep it in the positive mode, to not let the material issues drag us down. You know, not let material gravity drag us down, which causes you to flip the sign of the use of your spiritual consciousness, right? Innately, that spiritual consciousness up at the highest levels, you know, that you were in, relative to your encirclement in the Holy Spirit by grace, okay, that's in a positive mode. Don't pollute it by dragging it down by material worries, right? And cause it to flip sign. You have to choose to keep it in that positive mode. You know, that's in your free will hands. I mean, see, that's the issue with free will. You know, the universe is not allowed to make it so that you can't flip the sign or you wouldn't have free will.
Yeah, so give us this day our dread for tomorrow. One letter.
Yeah, not dread for tomorrow, bread for tomorrow.
I was so close.
but just, you know, remember that that's the interesting thing about those developmental epochs is, you know, the first two, it's like, okay, we're dealing with the, you know, with our hunger issues, and, you know, we've gotten over most of those basic things. We're feeding ourselves well now. Okay, now we're dealing with our fear issues, and, you know, we've got ourselves reasonably secure. You know, it's in this, you know, you're conquering these very foundational difficulties. But the next one is not like that. The next age is the kind of the, when all is said and done, the point of it is for you to follow the delights of self and discover the calamities of that pursuit. It's for you to actualize the potential contrast between what you desire things to be and what you've wrought out of your selfishness. Right? And to choose something else.
Is that right? Education age?
The material comfort era. Yeah, that's the point of the material comfort era. It's not what this, the title sounds like. The whole point is material comfort. Well, okay, yes and no. But I mean, the bigger point. I mean, yeah, you need some comfort, right, so that you can reflect and stuff. You have, you know, you need that leisure time. They're going to talk about that. But like I said, in the biggest sense, when all is said and done, the real point is that contrast to develop. That every world has to manifest grotesque tyranny, intolerance, you know, gluttony, drunkenness, you know, greed, whatnot. I mean, because it's only that stark contrast that gets evolutionary man to go, oh, I get it. We can't pick it up on subtle things. It takes a stark contrast.
And you're headed towards, after that,
the quest for knowledge and wisdom. See, you're motivated in quest of knowledge and wisdom by the starkness of what you get when you're not motivated. See? You know, you don't just sort of, you know, in the absence of any tyranny, you don't just go, you know, I should go on a sublime quest for knowledge and wisdom. You only will do that in the face of great pain and suffering. It's a stark fact about the evolutionary process. You know, it's kind of the effort, struggle, conflict thing writ large, see? Right? Notice the nutrition, epic, security, age, material comfort. Effort, struggle, conflict. They're in parallel. Right? The nutrition age is the effort. The security age is the struggle. And then in the material comfort area, despite the name, see, is the conflict. Right?
You know we're going to take that good thing to an extreme.
Right? It's where you finally, in the face of conflict, recognize, take that next step. Okay, so yes, and it has the spark of faith, obviously. I mean, the quest for knowledge and wisdom has a nucleus to it, genuine faith. Right? You're not going to be going very far in the quest for knowledge and wisdom if you can't look up the proper definition of the word faith in the dictionary. If it still says something about a certain kind of belief, like our dictionaries do, it tells you we're not in the quest for knowledge and wisdom yet. We must still be in the material comfort era, where it's like, I just have to believe. I have to believe very credulously, and then everything's going to be okay, right? I mean, that's not the quest for knowledge and wisdom. That's not the predicate for the quest for knowledge and wisdom. You know, credulous belief. Genuine faith is. So see what they did in those first two paragraphs. They just reminded you of, you got the biologic issues, then you have that basic developmental sequence. Okay, what else do they have to say?
But cultural society is no great and beneficent club of inherited privilege into which all men are born with free membership and entire equality. Rather is it an exalted and ever-advancing guild of earth workers, admitting to its ranks only the nobility of those toilers who strive to make the world a better place in which their children and their children's children may live and advance in subsequent ages. And this guild of civilization exacts costly admission fees, imposes strict and rigorous disciplines, visits heavy penalties on all dissenters and nonconformists, while it confers few personal licenses or privileges except those of enhanced security against common dangers and racial perils.
Ah, see, now we're getting to the point. See, like I said, we're done with the little predicate issues. Now we're to the point.
Don't forget tariffs.
All these things, you know, that are so immediately relevant as you listen to that paragraph just now. I mean, I would hope that you had at least 10 points of recognition Oops. Oh, dear. Oops. Uh-oh. right? Right? How many people now, right, in the midst of the seemingly just automatic material comfort, right, it just seems to happen, that you're born into, you know, believe that, you know, it's just a beneficent club of inherited privilege, right? All right, into which all men are born with free membership and entire equality, right? Born equal, right? And, right, how many people have forgotten that none of the, these pleasures that we get so immediately now happen naturally? You know, how many remember how quickly you could go back to a very prickly state of affairs like it was for a million years? How recently it was that we were drinking our sewage, okay, and things, just, you know, insane things like that, right? It's
well, in Detroit, it was just not too long
ago. Yeah, right. Yeah.
Did you say Flint?
It's so tenuous. Right, but there's so many people, you know, that are, all that stuff just happens automatically. Now we can do all these grand, exalted, idealistic things. No, you can't. You're getting way ahead of yourself. Because the moment that you set your sights on some, light and life tomorrow illusion, is the moment you're starving to death and the hordes are killing you. Because you forgot you have to keep your eye on those balls, for instance. Okay, so there's that obvious opening statement there, right? It's just, okay, so rather it's an exalted and ever-advancing guild of earth workers, right? You think of, like, Jesus holding up the Hebrew saying, if he who will not work shall not eat, right? Earth workers, admitting to its ranks only the nobility of those toilers, who strive to make the world a better place in which their children and their children's children may live and advance in subsequent ages. A couple things there. One, that it's, you know, it's a distinct nobility, right? It's, you're having to choose this state. Okay? You have to choose. And it's sad to record that so few persons on your rancha choose to be among the nobility of those toilers. But then notice how they word you this issue of striving to make the world a better place, not in the unfortunate abstract mode that everyone is in these days. Right? You know, thinks they want to make the world a better place. No. Make the world a better place in which their children, right, and their children's children, not those people's children. That's not where you start. No, you start, right, because the family is the nucleus for all the institutions that will eventually lead to a world that will be a world of peace and advancement. Right? No, it starts, you know, you're focused on, you want to make the world a better place for your children. It might seem selfish, but no, I mean, you have to start with something you can manage. You can't try to make the world a better place for all children. You won't succeed. Not to mention your first duty, you know, is as a parent to your children. And you're so focusing on those people on the other side of the planet, I don't have time for my children. I got to worry about those people, you know. And so your children grow up pitiful, right? And destroy everything that you have done to try to make the world a better place.
Like the oxygen mask analogy.
Yes, the oxygen mask analogy. Right? If there's an emergency on the flight. Yes. Right. So to see that issue, and of course bringing in children's children, because you want to be a little bit beyond Andonite, right? You want to be something that can consciousize your grandchildren, Right? That's your goal. A world, a better place for your children and your grandchildren. And if you've got that all pinned down brilliantly, then there's probably some space left in your life to go beyond that. Okay? But, you know, but again, notice that they didn't say make the little sphere that your family exists in a better place for your children and grandchildren. No, they did say make the world a better place. Right? So you're focused on your children, but you're doing things in a mode that has a very holistic consciousness. Yeah. It's just that you're not trying to encompass all the individuals in that whole, right? Just the individuals that are your arm size within that whole, but you're thinking in a holistic fashion. Okay, so just all those little details of how they word it to reflect on why they said it that way. You got something?
Well, the picture's large, but the children and children's children speaking to motivation. Mm-hmm. Somehow we can, it's easy to get a grand idea of what we're truly motivated by, and a lot of it can be false, imagined.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Oh, I care about the world.
Yeah.
Do I really?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. So many of those people, like, you know, I mean, they don't even care for their children or grandchildren. I mean, you know, when it boils down, they put themselves first. You know, a lot of times they'll do things in the name of making the world a better place, when really all they want is, you know, is recognition and honor for themselves. Look at this person. We should give them an award for being so conscientious of the world or something. I mean, and that's all they're looking for. Is just that incessant clamoring self, you know, for recognition and honor, is just looking to be satisfied, right? It's that Pharisaic thing. I just gave some money to a poor person. You know, they blow their horn, okay? Right, do they really care for the poor person? No, not at all. Right, it's all just about themselves, right? You know, let's hold a grand gala and pat each other on the back about how much we contribute to other people's, you know, other poor people, right? Is it really about the poor people, or just a way to impress yourself and be impressive to others around you? Is it just vanity? Right? You know, remember how important vanity was in getting things going when you read the, you know, the evolution of things in the, you know, in the Rancher book.
Negative to think about all those people out there that want abortion, abortion, abortion. They want to kill their babies. They're not thinking about their children and their children's children. They're just thinking about themselves, having a, you know. Yeah, I mean, again, okay. It's horrible. Right, so let's talk about, you know, that issue. I mean, you know, we'll get to that, you know, that's coming up in the marriage and family papers, but we, you know, we can remind ourselves of how that fits in. It's
right, there's, you know, there's always been abortion and infanticide. You know, as they point out, the, we have a very unfortunate thing that's happening in recent times, where it's not issues of, you know, I mean, the village only has so many resources or something, you know, we can only support so many people or stuff like that. You know, I mean, these issues of, you know, the nutrition epic and stuff, you know, these kind of basic issues like that. I mean, as they point out, no, these days it's purely selfish. Well, you know, that will diminish my self-pleasure. Right? It doesn't have anything to do with economic reasons or anything like that. It's just, it's become an institution for self-gratification. Right? Not self-maintenance or whatnot, right? But self-gratification. Right? And that, as they point out, that's, you know, I mean, you know, not even the primitives were that unfortunately motivated. Like I said, see, that's a pre-primitive sort of a motivation. Right? You know, and I mean, you know, you know, yes, sure, there's health issues. I mean, sometimes, okay, you know, you have to make difficult decisions about the health of the mother. You know, and we all know all those. See, but that the whole point is, yeah, but notice that the problem is not that there are difficult decisions about, like I said, you know, that are relative to the very basic material facts of existence. Right? More and more, it has nothing to do with those. It's just purely an issue of, you know, that will diminish the delights of self, right? And I don't want to have anything that diminishes that. I mean, marriage, too. It's like, you know, marriage, that's just too inconvenient. That just too much diminishes. See, I just, you know, we're going to talk about that a lot in the next block of papers, you know, that whole self-gratification fixation that we have, you know?
Well, it seems to me that, there's a lot of valid reasons for abortion.
Yeah, like I was just saying, yeah. Right, see, I'm not contesting any of those. Right, it's just having the discrimination ability to discriminate between valid issues and very difficult decisions about them with invalid motivations. Right, you know, having the courage to not just lump it all mindlessly together, that's it's those difficult things that the revelators trying to get us to, you know, to have, to not approach things so simplistically, and also to not, you know, to be in that mode where you're noticing the issues, like I was just saying about the material comfort era. On every planet, right, abortion would increase for self-gratification reasons during the material comfort era. See, that's just going to be natural, right? But when you're killing, you know, millions and millions of babies, maybe it gets to be an extreme enough thing where someone goes, you know, wait a minute. Maybe there's a higher principle than myself. All right? Maybe I should go in the quest of knowledge and wisdom. And it's like I was just saying. I mean, those harsh things when all is said and done, are what the material comfort here is about. Gross excesses in the name of self that finally awaken you to righteousness in contrast to self-righteousness. That's the whole point. You know, you don't need this in Havona, right? They don't need such grotesque contrasts to get it. Right, they have a subtle mind. Right, we don't. We have a very coarse mind. You know, many have a horrendously coarse mind. I mean, it has to go to 10 orders of magnitude increase before they even notice it. Oh, I just noticed something. Like what? Yeah. I mean, that's just the way it is. We're a very coarse-eyed people. Right, all the fine things just don't even enter don't enter our awareness, yes. So that just means it's going to go to very, very harsh degrees on this planet before people start waking up. Yeah. Okay, so then what they're getting, came back to this paragraph. You know, after the children's children comment there. And this guild of civilization exacts costly admission fees, imposes strict and rigorous disciplines, visits heavy penalties on all dissenters and nonconformists. Okay, we've talked about that before, right? See, that's the harsh facts. There's no way a civilization can endure if you're wishy-washy about the specifics. It's like, no, that is not allowed. Period. You can't be so judgmental. The society has to, right? It has to draw lines, stark lines, and you're just not allowed to cross them. Sure, if you bring in some advancing, it's like, well, you know, in an advanced, enlightened age, we would be more tolerant of things. Okay, yeah, but you're not. You know, never mention you won't have to be so tolerant in some advanced age, because all of those people that manifest such gross nonconformity like that don't exist biologically, you know, in those advanced ages. Okay, but it's just a society can only endure so much internal tension before it rips itself apart, right? And just because we're not going to use some foolish, well, God told us that this person, you know, all these kind of people have to be executed or something. Okay, we're not going to do things like people did in the past, maybe, but you still have to draw lines. Just because you don't falsely exalt your primitive notions under the banner of God anymore doesn't mean that there aren't, don't still need definitive lines, boundaries to your society. Is another reminder of, you know, why you need the courage of that courageous and independent cosmic thinking. When it goes beyond you, you need a lot of courage just within you to face the cosmos and your limitations. But when it goes to society in general, I mean, you have to be rugged, right? Advancing civilization is not for those timid souls. Okay? You have to be able to face, you know, that you have to do this period, or there's going to be heavy penalties. Right? But you're not going to, you know, as you advance, hopefully there's something besides just raw animal fear that keeps you from stepping over a line. Right, more and more, you know, it's not the best for society at large, and in the long run, it's not best for you either if you step across that line. So you just don't. Right? Taboo doesn't keep you from stepping over the line anymore. You know, wisdom, insight, and foresight keep you from stepping over the line.
You mean you gotta go to hell doesn't work?
Right. You know, when you recognize that there isn't, you know, the fear of hell that mitigates your behavior, right? It has to be something there has to be definitive clarity within your mind about why the line is there, right?
We're definitely in a transition.
Yeah, right. We're in the transition of that. We're in that difficult adolescent stage of transitioning, right? From the child fear, right, that kept you from crossing the line, to something that hasn't manifested yet. But it's just, you know, they try, you know, they lay it out very stark, you know, using all these stark words, you know, costly admission fees, imposes strict and rigorous disciplines, like every word there, you know, is prickly. Because it has to be definitive like that. You all know that if anyone even suggests on a societal level some sort of like rigorous, strict or something, well, that's so mean. You know, that's the response you get. You can't be mean like that, right? We've forgotten that you have to be strict, right? Or it all comes apart. Humans tried it, yeah, you know, the other ways. Right? If we try it another way, we're not trying anything new. It was done, tried every way, shape, and form without strictness over tens and tens of thousands of years. And we discovered experientially the only solution is strict boundaries. Any other thing, eventually, it rips the society apart. And it finally tears it apart enough that the neighboring tribe that is stricter kills you all. Let's see here. Just one other little thing. The common dangers and racial perils. It's kind of interesting that they throw in the racial perils there at the end. Just reminding you that it's inescapable that some of the perils in play can't help but have a racial predicate. You know, we naturally have issues with people that are racially different, right? And so, you know, unless you have a very kind of broad, enlightened civilization, it can very easily slip into a mode where people are not being treated as spiritual equals in the society. Okay. Just the perils of that, you know, and kind of even beyond the immediate things you would think, you know, they're just saying that to remind you of the differences between individuals biologically, even if it isn't technically racial, but just individual differences biologically, right? You have to see to that, and a big broad group helps with that, right? You know, a very narrow society, you know, can much more easily slip into the mode where it would subjugate in various ways society, you know, in the society a certain group of people, as untouchables or whatever, right? Okay, so that was a, you know, that's a big paragraph. A lot of the meat is there.
Social association is a form of survival insurance which human beings have learned is profitable. Therefore, are most individuals willing to pay those premiums of self-sacrifice and personal liberty curtailment, which society exacts from its members in return for this enhanced group protection? In short, the present-day social mechanism is a trial-and-error insurance plan designed to afford some degree of assurance and protection against a return to the terrible and antisocial conditions which characterized the early experiences of the human race.
Okay, so I was already hinting at, like, you know, this is an experiential discovery. Trial and error. Like I said, you know, everything you can imagine in terms of the societal structure has been tried. And a long, difficult process has led to, you know, a certain mores systems. And again, that's not recognized. Everyone is like, oh, we can just throw out those mores, you know, as if they were just dreamt up yesterday arbitrarily. Like, no, those are the product of a million years of trial and error, right? Where error was very painful, right? Everyone died. Everyone was slaughtered, you know, whatever. Right. The consequences were swift and sure, and slowly over time, people recognized that, you know, you have to have certain basic aspects to your mores system, or you're just dooming yourself as a society. And you notice that they even brought in, like, because, like I said, we're definitely thinking about civilization where there's some genuine humans involved, you know, and beyond the technical level, okay, of you being a human by grace, so that it's not just they don't just use the word freedom, right? See, personal liberty curtailment, right? So what are they reminding you of there, right? I mean, technically, liberty is a spirit word, right? That technically only directly exists, you know, in your inner sanctum, right, in your genuine inner life, where you are sovereign and have free will, spirit over mind. But we all know how many people quickly forget that and turn that consciousness inside out, you know, and want to have free will existing out there, right? Where I have certain desires that are now demands upon all the molecules around me, living and dead, right? Now, all the things are going to be arranged like this, and all the beings are going to be arranged like this, and all the beings are going to behave like this, and it's all centered on me because I've turned my liberty inside out, and want my liberty to reign out there rather than the only place where it properly exists. It's not even in the lower, you know, if you use the hourglass analogy, it's not even in the lower domain. There's things in the lower domain, you know, that mind in the lower domain of the hourglass analogy that you can't do anything about. There, in this life perforce you serve two masters. I mean, that lower domain is bound to material issues. You know, if nothing else, just your genetics. And no amount of exercising your free will is going to give you different chromosomes. It's just what they are. Okay? You know, and so, you know, you and see, this is one of the reasons why humans take it all the way out and want to start manipulating things and beings out there. You know, they go to the, you know, they start in the upper domain with this recognition of liberty, and they take it to the next location, right, the lower domain, and they can't control it, right? No matter how much they squint, right, their genetics don't change, and they get frustrated. And it's like, well, if I can't change myself, I'm going to change everyone else. I'm going to set up a totalitarian system where I rule everything and every being. And, you know, and finally, I'm going to have the liberty I desire. Right? You have this tendency, see, to go all the way inside out like that because of your frustration internally with yourself and that other master that your mind serves. But anyway, the point is, see, that, you know, and they even accent it with personal liberty curtailment, right, that you, you know, the more enlightened you get, the less you do that. I mean, initially you have to sort of be forced. It's like, okay, they just won't let me turn myself inside out. They'll execute me if I try it, right? But eventually you recognize it's inappropriate, you know, and you cease to do it, right? And you discover genuine happiness. You give it some time, and you actually are grown into something that does have some self-control. Unlike how frustrating it was when you first tried it and didn't work. when that lower domain has a natural negative response to an external negative stimulus, but you take control of that mind or self and have a positive response to that negative stimulus, and you experience happiness, right? See, that happiness comes from the proper exercise of your genuine personal liberty, right? And finally, your mind is beginning to become free from antecedent causation, right, of that other master. And it's so delightful, right? And that exquisite delight is what the word happiness is referring to.
Service.
Right. And it's like when you start to get control of yourself like that, think of the potentials for serving others, right? That when you'll actually be able to serve others when it's not all about, well, when all is said and done, what I really want is a reward for how much, you know, how much a great server I am of others, right? You know, more
by my side to do what I want to do.
An award, yes. All you want is an award. The more you get control of yourself, the less that unfortunate thing of being the Pharisee blowing your horn happens. That's the natural thing. Don't be delusional, right? That is the natural thing. There isn't a single person that's ever been born where that isn't the natural instinct. Right, that after you ladle the soup to blow the horn, I hope someone took a picture of me, you know, ladling the soup, and posted in their newsletter. I mean, that's just your natural animal instinct. You have to take control of that.
Yep. The way I look at this paragraph, so the self-sacrifice of personal liberty curtailment. So, in other words, the way I'm looking at it, if we didn't have this personal liberty curtailment, and self-sacrifice. Mm-hmm. People could go out and start stealing everything because they want everything, you know? And then, but because they realize that that would be an antisocial way of living and all the mm-hmm. terrible things that will happen because of it.
Right.
You know, that's how I see
it. And just one other little thing before we go to the next paragraph along that line to just strengthen it. If you are familiar with the way I've annotated the levels of meaning, you know, and on some of those little handouts that I've done, you might remember when you get up to the fourth level, the level of kindness, the level of brotherly love. Yeah, I have a little annotation there about mutual self-sacrifice. See, that's why they say self-sacrifice there. Indirectly, they're reminding you of that brotherly love, that level of kindness, right, that you are functioning in relative to others in the society. You know, it starts literally with your biologic family and moves outward from that nucleus, where more and more people are your neighbor, right, and fall in that sphere of kindness, that sphere of brotherly love. Okay, mutual self-sacrifice. All sacrifice for you, but okay, this is kindness. That means you reciprocate and you sacrifice for me. And we all sacrifice for one another. And we have a brotherly love society now. Okay. What else do they give us here?
Society thus becomes a cooperative scheme for securing civil freedom through institutions, economic freedom through capital and invention, social liberty through culture, and freedom from violence through police regulation.
Okay, so there's the, in general, so they bring up freedoms, and all sort of different dimensions of freedom. But you notice that they reminded you of a personal, spiritual predicate in the one, social liberty through culture, right? I mean, obviously there's freedom there too. That liberty implies freedom, but they just wanted, in that instance, wanted to remind you of, you know, that sort of immediacy of going from the spiritual to the social. You know, like you can even think about it, you know, with the sixth and the fifth adjutants. Right? The spiritual aspect of your sixth adjutant going to the social aspect of your fifth. Right? They're you know, adjacent adjutants, okay? You know, or you know, the you know, that which is value, spiritual, you know, and then immediately the benefactor of that, that which has value, right, the social. Right? So again, just notice their use of the contrast between freedom and liberty. Just reminding you of when you're talking about civil, economic, okay, you know those sorts of, you know, security issues. Okay, just saying freedom, but kind of, you know, that which is a little bit more, you know, less out, all out there, and a little bit more kind of coming in. They're reminding you of how it goes up to a liberty source. That liberty is downstepped into freedoms. Okay, what else they got there?
Might does not make right, but it does enforce the commonly recognized rights of each succeeding generation. The prime mission of government is the definition of the right, the just and fair regulation of class differences, and the enforcement of equality of opportunity under the rules of law. Every human right is associated with a social duty. Group privilege is an insurance mechanism which unfailingly demands the full payment of the exacting premiums of group service. And group rights, as well as those of the individual, must be protected, including the regulation of the sex propensity.
Okay, so we don't need to go through every point. There's a lot of points. But just notice they're laying out, like I said, so many of these specific issues that you must keep your eye on in order for this to be an ongoing phenomenon, this civilization. Before I get to the italicized sentence here, just notice little things like they say the just and fair regulation of class differences. They don't say the fair and just. You're going, well, isn't it just then, then fair? Right, I mean, shouldn't just be the foundational one? And then fairness is built upon that foundation? Why did they say just and fair? Well, they're not just talking about the individual here, moving up the levels of meaning. Right? I mean, you're talking about society. Now, and it's very important that when you're thinking about society, you can't be, I don't care about fairness. I demand justice. You can't have that be first. Right? You have to, submit yourself more, right, to the demands of society first. Right? Okay, it needs to be fair first. Right? And then on that foundation of that, see that mutual phenomenon of fairness. Okay, then I have my individual issues of my individual justice. Little things like that, just they're always so delightfully precise like that. And we've talked about every human right is associated with a social duty, a properly conceived right. Now, we might just notice, like, well, wait a minute, is this a correct use of the word right? Well, when we talked about human rights before, it doesn't start with an incredibly objective concept of righteousness, conformity with the cosmos, and your use of rights. But it's the spirit of it is there. You're thinking that there's some sort of overarching phenomenon, within which, under which you have a right. It's the beginnings of the recognition of the cosmos and conformity to it and the use of the word right and righteousness in that mode. And so, now, the revelators, it isn't just because that's the way we talk about it. It's like, well, we got to use the word right because that's the way they talk about it. You can recognize the evolutionary validity, of using that word. Just like conformity to the mores is the beginning of a recognition of moral conformity, which is, again, see, conformity to the cosmos, right? But you start small. And then you can just, like I said, I'm not going to go through all the details there. We'll talk a lot about the sex propensity regulation issue when we get into the marriage and family papers. We all know how problematic that is. But the big italicized sentence, might does not make right, but it does enforce the commonly recognized rights of each succeeding generation. See, they italicized that because they know when you get more and more spiritually conscious like we are now, that issue can get fuzzy.
Yeah.
No, there's a place, an inescapable place for might. Okay. Again, we were talking above about there has to be definitive lines drawn. Okay. If people naturally resist those lines, only power. I can enforce those lines. There has to be. It's just inescapable. If might doesn't enforce the commonly recognized rights of each succeeding generation, what happens to the civilization? It falls apart.
Okay. Along with all the rights.
Along with all the rights. Yeah. All right.
You have a right to fear and hunger.
Yes. The only thing you have a natural right to is fear and hunger. Yes.
I think a key thing here that we often forget today is the group rights.
Yeah.
Everybody's concerned about their individual rights.
Yes.
But the society has rights.
Right.
And if society's rights aren't protected, There can't be
a society
for individual rights.
Right. See, and again, that's the reason. Like I said, that the reason we forget that, right, that there's group rights, is because more and more people are turning themselves inside out. Right. So all there is individual rights. Right. I am the individual, and everyone has to orbit about me. Right. Right. You exalt the self above all else when you turn yourself inside out like that. Yeah.
So that it reminds me a little bit about, render under Caesar the things that are Caesar, and under God mm-hmm. the things that are God's. Because,
sure.
Might, the first part, might does not make right. And it certainly doesn't if might wants to render, themselves as a god, so to speak.
Right, the material comforter tyranny, for instance, and the might behind it, yeah.
Yeah, right. But, right, in that aspect. So that's just, sort of like at some point, and it does have the, commonly recognized rights for each other, but I don't think they're talking about it in that way, but I can see how, in that way, which you see happening in certain parts of the world today, where religious freedom is just totally non-existent or being crushed, and that's a tough thing by might.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so in that particular situation, I don't think it does enforce the common, recognized rights of each succeeding generation.
See, obviously, so the trick is, it's like, okay, so I can't just demonize might. But I also can't, just let it run free. Obviously, there's going to need to be greater and greater wisdom to properly use the tool of might. Might there must be, but, it obviously must be ever more objectively and wisely regulated. But like Jesus said to the condemned criminal, your society has the right to use its might to execute you.
And there is a God, though.
I'm going to minister to you personally, right? But that doesn't change the fact that they have a right to exercise their might and say, I'm sorry, you're too antisocial. You are going to destroy this society. We're going to execute you. That right? They have that, as Jesus said, they have that right. Right? Right. Okay.
Liberty subject to group regulation is the legitimate goal of social evolution. Liberty without restrictions is the vain and fanciful dream of unstable and flighty human minds.
So when you turn yourself inside out like that, you are unstable and flighty. Right, and so, wow, as Gene was pointing out, a lot of people do that. Yeah, see, that's a problem. to label a mind that would do that, it's fundamentally an unstable mind. It's begun to use its free will to destabilize itself from the stability of the encirclement in the cosmos. Right? It's a self-righteous mind. See, that's the essence of the instability is the self-righteousness. Self-righteousness is unstable. Righteousness is conformity with the cosmos. Sounds kind of stable to me. Mm-hmm. Yeah. The opposite would obviously be unstable. And then it's going off on a flight of self-righteousness, that flighty mind. And remember, the literal meaning of vain, empty. Right? Not just that it's, you're gonna not be successful, right? Okay. But it's literally nothingness that you're in quest of, emptiness, the void of oblivion. Anyway, so there's the predicate. Let's get into some of the details here in the next section.
Section 6, the maintenance of civilization. While biologic evolution has proceeded ever upward, Much of cultural evolution went out from the Euphrates Valley in waves, which successively weakened as time passed until finally the whole of the pure line Adamic posterity had gone forth to enrich the civilizations of Asia and Europe. The races did not fully blend, but their civilizations did to a considerable extent mix. Culture did slowly spread throughout the world, and this civilization must be maintained and fostered, for there exist today no new sources of culture, no Andites to invigorate and stimulate the slow progress of the evolution of civilization.
Okay. Everyone basically recognized, but so they start again by reminding you of a little bit about the biologic predicate, but also the tenuousness of this. Because you didn't get the extensive biologic predicate like you would have without the default, the civilization that spread out is all the more fragile because it is so unnatural. There's so little naturalness because of our limited genetics, right, to civilization. So they're reminding you that this is a very fragile fact that did spread out through the world. We like they're saying, see, it must be maintained and fostered. It's not going to maintain and foster itself because of very limited genetics. So there's one of those musts in the book. So like I said, that's the main point. They're trying to give us these key things that we must keep in mind. And it's not one or two things. It's a lot of things. So this is not easy to keep your eye on all these balls. Okay? This last section is very long. Okay? So it just reminds you of how easy it would be for us to forget about one key element and have the whole thing collapse because of it. The length of this section speaks to that. Just how fragile a state we're, just how much of an emergency we're in. So what are some of the specific points they bring out?
The civilization which is now evolving on Urantia grew out of and is predicated on the following factors. 1. Natural circumstances. The nature and extent of a material civilization is in large measure determined by the natural resources available, climate, weather, and numerous physical conditions are factors in the evolution of culture.
Okay, so just first little thing to highlight here. Notice in the little preface there, they said predicated on. Like I said, I mean, these are all essential here. It's all resting on these foundational elements. Like I said, if one of them falls, everything collapses into that hole.
There's a lot of them.
And there's a lot of, like I said, it's very extensive. But the civilization grew out of and is predicated on, not some of these, but all these factors. Okay, and the first one, just think about in the bigger sense, besides the immediacy of natural resources and whatnot. But civilization is fundamentally unnatural. That which is unnatural is predicated on the natural. So just in a very sweeping sense, that's the very first thing they're reminding you of. Natural circumstances, right? The unnatural is predicated on the natural. If you didn't need natural, right, you wouldn't have all of our naturalness, right? That's a foundation. So then you just, don't so focus on the unnatural, and I'm always highlighting it, that you go, that you start thinking dichotomies about the natural. No, right, the unnatural rests upon the natural, okay? But the unnatural is higher than the natural. Yeah.
It's just amazing how many things we've noticed over the last couple of months are dependent on climate.
Right. So you notice again, are they going to we saw that, so they're going to remind you of that again. See, in this final overview.
It's almost set up that way.
Yeah. Right. And it's just, it so reminds you of how it's the things and beings aren't really separate, right? It's one system. And that becomes more and more obvious the more civilization advances. And they notice they even put in weather.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, you know, not just the long-term aspect of climate, but just the temporal vicissitudes of weather. If it's a extremely variable weather, that's difficult. Okay?
Storm named Michael.
Okay. I mean, maybe the climate is, maybe the climate is very, very constant. Okay. But it oscillates a lot about that, about that mean. All these issues, be it, the dirt or the air, right, are all predicates. What else do they say here?
At the opening of the Andite era, there were only two extensive and fertile open hunting ground areas in all the world. One was in North America and was overspread by the Amerinds. The other was to the north of Turkestan and was partly occupied by an Andonic yellow race. The decisive factors in the evolution of a superior culture in southwestern Asia were race and climate. The Andites were a great people, but the crucial factor in determining the course of their civilization was the increasing aridity of Iran, Turkestan, and Sinkiang, which forced them to invent and adopt new and advanced methods of wresting a livelihood from their decreasingly fertile lands.
Okay, so that forcing, the italicized forced there. And in the middle of that, you see them emphasizing just what you're bringing up about climate. The order is not climate and race, it's race and climate. The climate is the foundational element, right? The predicate upon which a significant racial fact, the Andites, could do something profound. If it wasn't for the climate, they would have been, playing around with themselves and not going anywhere fast. But that predicate of climate was the indispensable stimulus to them to do something with their human nature, right? Instead of just resting on their fancy animal laurels.
It's the town size forced.
All right. It's a climate forcing.
But climate alone won't do it either, because...
Right.
If they weren't Andites,
yes,
the climate would change and
exactly.
People would just starve.
Right, they would just starve. Right. Yes. Right. So that's why it's race and there's an and there, race and climate, right? Okay, but they're just reminding you of, like I said, these predicates, right, to civilization. They've told that story several times, but they're just reminding you of that story again. That's the, it's obviously the great example in all of human history of how this works. You had the climatic change, and you had the people that could rise to the challenge. You're going, well, now if we become really sad to record that we don't initiate ourselves, you suppose we'll have to be forced again? Well, one of the primary forcings is climate. I wonder if the climate will change again.
No, but I can tell you something interesting. Which is really going to make a big difference in our world, and that is the Algalaga aquifers will be totally run out of water in 20 years,
right,
which irrigates most of all the United States, or all the breadbasket.
Yeah.
And when that happens, I mean, we're going to be forced, along with whatever happens in Florida, we're going to be forced.
We might actually have to use our minds. right. Yeah. Yeah, it's like, no, God would never allow the aquifers to go dry. It's like, no, it doesn't work that way. God would plan for the aquifers to go dry so that you actually have to use your minds. Right, that we just see, it's this natural circumstances as a predicate. Right, they're just reminding you of that. What else we have here?
The configuration of continents and other land arrangement situations are very influential in determining peace or war. Very few Urantians have ever had such a favorable opportunity for continuous and unmolested development as has been enjoyed by the peoples of North America, protected on practically all sides by vast oceans.
Okay, and it's a separate paragraph, but oh, wait a minute. It's actually hearkening back to the previous one. All right, the Amerinds were the only ones that were in that open hunting area, right? One of the two. And like I said, you have 80,000 years and not really doing much with it.
No, remember the plan? It was supposed to be Adam's children come over here.
Right, and that which Revelation failed to accomplish, evolution eventually achieved. Eventually, right, that Adamic blood did get here by the millions. Right, didn't happen the way they were initially planned. But see, they're just reminding you. It's not a coincidence that there was a place on the planet where kind of the spear point of Andite culture could have a chunk of time to kind of get itself firmly in place, because oceans were, making it so that it wasn't so easy to have the hordes attack you. We all know, though, that grace is now passing.
And
the oceans aren't as big a boundaries as they used to be, right? Yeah. Right. But so in other words, I hope you used your time well, because you now are you're going to face challenges. They were just reminding you. Like I said, it's all one system: the humans and the things. There's no coincidentally to the shapes and locations of continents on any world. It all works into the system. And it even's like, well, I bet you they didn't plan for a rebellion and a default. Well, coincidentally, the continents on this planet worked out so that, oh, well, this is probably just this planet. Well, there is that neighboring planet where coincidentally there's an island continent that... it's impossible to catch the supreme, right... outside of his grand plan. Okay. And it all works. Okay. All right. What else do we have here?
Two, capital goods. Culture is never developed under conditions of poverty. Leisure is essential to the progress of civilization. Individual character of moral and spiritual value may be acquired in the absence of material wealth, but a cultural civilization is only derived from those conditions of material prosperity which foster leisure combined with ambition.
Okay, so like I said, we'd be getting to see that's a part of the material comfort area, that maybe is more immediately recognizable, right? That until you get over those issues of hunger and fear, you just don't have the leisure for reflective thinking. So there's no way you can have cultural civilization like they're saying there. It needs a significant philosophic nature to it in order for it to exist. Okay, so the material comfort era definitely allows for that to happen, I think everyone probably recognizes, we've talked about it, the tendency for the demonization of capital and all these unfortunate modalities that certain people get into, because they just totally demonize their own material pragmatism. Side to their consciousness. and get off on these material idealism, falsehood tangents. So they demonize capital, for instance. Culture is never developed under conditions of poverty, right? When you have conditions of poverty, you have the interregnum, right? Almost everyone is poor serfs and a handful of rich elites, right?
Jesus did talk about the inequality of capital distribution.
Of course, right?
So there's a happy medium. There's wisdom there.
If you don't exercise wisdom, it will go to medieval modality, right? That's the natural estate. The small number of individuals that can always take any situation and profit from it, and they will be the lords, and everyone else will be the serfs. Right? That's just a natural estate. There's no middle class. Middle class. Middle class is unnatural. See, so again, when you see the declining middle class, things are slipping back into a natural estate. Right? They just go hand in hand. There's nothing natural about a middle class. That's a phenomenon of the unnaturalness of genuine civilization. Okay.
During primitive times, life on your ranch was a serious and sober business. And it was to escape this incessant struggle and interminable toil that mankind constantly tended to drift toward the salubrious climate of the tropics. While these warmer zones of habitation afforded some remission from the intense struggle for existence, the races and tribes who thus sought ease seldom utilized their unearned leisure for the advancement of civilization. Social progress has invariably come from the thoughts and plans of those races that have, by their intelligent toil, learned how to wrest a living from the land with lessened effort and shortened days of labor, and thus have been able to enjoy a well-earned and profitable margin of leisure.
So again, harsh winters force human manifestation into, otherwise you just lay there, as a fancy animal with your mouth open waiting for the dates to drop in your mouth, from the palm overhead. They're just reminding you again of that. And, kind of how the previous one, ties into this one. That environmental forcing leads those who are able to meet the challenge to produce capital, right? Think of what is capital? Capital is a fact that results from the existence of foresight, right? From human minds, right? They aren't just existing in the moment. They're capitalizing the moment. And again, remember, capital literally means you're using your head, right? there's some reflective thinking. There's some human thinking. There's some foresight.
Notice they went from unearned to well-earned.
Yeah. See?
Two descriptions.
Yeah, right. That the individual is using their human nature, creativity, and succeeding despite the environment, it's well earned, and there's happiness in the individuals as a result, right? Because they've risen above the negative forcing of the environment. Okay, what else do we have here?
3, scientific knowledge. The material aspect of civilization must always await the accumulation of scientific data. It was a long time after the discovery of the bow and arrow and the utilization of animals for power purposes before man learned how to harness wind and water, and to be followed by the employment of steam and electricity. But slowly the tools of civilization improved. Weaving, pottery, the domestication of animals, and metalworking were followed by an age of writing and printing.
Okay, so basically just And I want to emphasize that there is no significant civilization without a scientific foundation in place. You know, and so that's another reason why there's an emergency. Like I say all the time, over the course of the 20th century, the integrity of the scientific endeavor is mostly evaporated. And that's a very, very ominous sign because of what they're pointing out here. they're reminding you also remember, normally Adam and Eve would have fostered this element over their 25,000 years. So that by 10,000 BC, we would have had sort of full scientific knowledge, that full foundation for all the greater things that follow, you know, with the magisterial son and the bestowal son and the Trinity teacher sons and all that. Again, it's a foundational aspect. But evolution, slowly, right, is bringing into play what they would have fostered, you know, and accelerated the evolution of.
I mean, that just happened recently.
Yeah, how recent is electricity? I mean, we all know about how relatively recent steam power is, you know, and of course, for instance, staff, we're trying to teach steam power 500,000 years ago. This scientific predicate, and you can understand that as being a predicate in civilization at large because it is within you. Right, you go to the upper domain in the hourglass analogy, and that that goal that you kind of, because of your sixth adjutant, are driven to seek that religious consciousness on the sixth level of meaning. Right, in order to get there, and obviously in order for it to be stable and have it, you know, resting on something, well, the fourth level of meaning is the level of scientific consciousness. Right? There's no stable, genuine religious consciousness except on the foundation of scientific consciousness on the fourth level. Right? Doesn't mean you're a professional scientist, right? But you have to have that first cosmic intuition, objective relationship to fact as a predicate for any genuine religious consciousness. God is a fact, not a figment of human imagination. Right? You have to be able to get to fact to get to God.
Fact's not feeling.
Yeah.
Delighted in recently.
Okay.
Knowledge is power. Invention always precedes the acceleration of cultural development on a worldwide scale. Science and invention benefited most of all from the printing press. And the interaction of all these cultural and inventive activities has enormously accelerated the rate of cultural advancement.
Okay. I think, I don't think we need to say a lot there. I mean, other than them laying out point blank knowledge is power. That's not delusional. That's a fact. And these, just again, like I was saying, the important role in this of science in the evolutionary process of civilization. Like you're saying, enormously accelerated. It's a foundation for your spiritual nature, so it brings in more of that spiritual mind and its ability for things to be accelerated, for things to evolve more geometrically and less arithmetically, like it happens when it's all just about what's in the lower domain. Okay. All right.
Science teaches man to speak the new language of mathematics and trains his thoughts along lines of exacting precision. And science also stabilizes philosophy through the elimination of error, while it purifies religion by the destruction of superstition.
Yeah, so like the last part, how important science is for a foundational element for philosophy and like you're saying about superstition with religion, And in that first part of, again, well, my quest is for God, not knowledge of things. Okay, well, God is a very precise fact. He's not a fuzzy fact, okay? You need to have the ability to think precisely, methodically, definitively. It's your thoughts, not your fuzzy feelings, that lead you Godward. Your precise thoughts, not your fuzzy feelings, that lead you Godward. Like I said, again, you can, and I can just literally visualize that. The precision of the fourth level in your scientific consciousness is a predicate for getting up to your genuine religious consciousness.
Yeah. What does that say about people who, for example, go to, I've seen people go to church and their, you know, profession is as scientists, and they go to church and they worship God, and when they're thinking about science, they put it in one compartment in mm-hmm. their mind, and they think mm-hmm. about God, and they put it in another compartment in their God, in their mind, mm-hmm. and they don't let them mix because they're mutually exclusive. They don't really go together. So this,
because of course that God that you know they're you know trying to relate to is a you know is. Awash in superstition. They have to compartmentalize it. But of course, the thing, you know, like I was saying, I mean, obviously, if you compartmentalize, there's no way you can get to the real God, like I was just saying. But also, I mean, this has a long-term consequence, right? The longer you try to keep science, you know, and some evolutionary religion fuzziness compartmentalized and ongoing, you know, separate like that, right? The superstitions and fuzziness of that evolutionary God notion is going to bleed over into your science, you know, and the budding precision of the three centuries of the Enlightenment will fuzz out in the 20th century and corrupt science.
Yeah. There has to be something higher to kind of override the fuzziness.
Yeah. I mean, science is what allows, you know, some scientific consciousness is what allows you to transcend evolutionary religion and get to the real God. Okay. You know, that evolutionary religion God notion that, you know, you upload it down into your lower domain and then, you know, and then are working on falsely exalting and corrupting your upper domain. See, I mean, that's not what you're looking for, is that God notion that you upload. You want to get up there in an unpolluted space and download a relationship to the real God. A God predicated on absolutely precise fact. Not one iota of fuzziness, right, to the real God. Okay. So the foundational aspect of science, both internally and externally.
Which they say in another part, science is basically, you know, you're trying to figure out how God works. In other words, it's our ability to mm-hmm. figure out how it all goes together. And when you do, as you said, when you do mm-hmm. start to really figure it out, it's, you know, it's amazingly precise. Mm-hmm. And to the extent that his laws are just not, you know, they're immutable.
Right. I mean, like, there's a physics to God.
It's and that, in a way, I think, should encourage the scientist, knowing that that's the foundation.
Right.
To be able to make, you know, better scientific discoveries and be able to have more insight into what they're looking for, I would think.
Mm-hmm. Just one other thing occurred to me as you were talking, I was looking at this. We've talked about how, you know, in Latin, of course, the word science means knowledge. And so when you see scientific knowledge for the title there, is that like knowledge-y knowledge? Well, I mean, it's, you know, so scientific knowledge another means systematized knowledge, right? You know, it's not just knowledge. It's to be genuine science, there's system, like, you know, here, science, system of ideas.
So is there wisdom in science too then?
Of course, genuine science is predicated on a philosophic picture, right? Yeah. Okay.
4, human resources. Manpower is indispensable to the spread of civilization. All things equal, a numerous people will dominate the civilization of a smaller race. Hence, failure to increase in numbers up to a certain point prevents the full realization of national destiny. But there comes a point in population increase where further growth is suicidal. Multiplication of numbers beyond the optimum of the normal man-land ratio means either a lowering of the standard of living or an immediate expansion of territorial boundaries by peaceful penetration or by military conquest, forcible occupation.
Okay. I mean, again, I'm just reminding you, we've talked about some of those issues, but again, you see the wisdom and insight and foresight to have this in the proper balance. All good things taken to extreme become bad. They're reminding you there. You know, and you can certainly think about those that overplay this overpopulation fear, you know, to the point where we start to not have enough people as a nation to sustain ourselves properly. We have to be the master of our fears. We can't let fear of overpopulation and these negative things they're talking about here drive us into oblivion, basically, as a civilization, because there's just not enough numbers.
Don't we have enough numbers?
Well, that's the question. You know, people declare we have enough and act on that. It's like, well, is that a proper assumption? Yeah, you can believe it's a proper assumption,
if that were true, why would you need unlimited immigration?
Right. We have all these things that are, in conflict. Same people that say that we shouldn't be procreating say that we should have unlimited immigration. Okay, I'm confused. We don't have a systematic understanding. So we have just beliefs that we absolutize. And we need to figure out, we need to put these assumptions to the test.
So did they ever say anything about what the normal man-land ratio is?
No, of course not. See, it obviously depends upon the place and the time. And the more technology they have, it changes what's, appropriate. It's a very complicated thing. It requires all kinds of, you figure out what's proper at a given time and place. Well, at a different time or a different place is a different normal. You can't take it all over the planet or whatever, or too many centuries into the future. I mean, it's a very complicated, dynamic, changing assessment that you have to be able to make.
They call it the normal.
Right,
see?
Right.
Man-land ratio.
What was that?
How would you describe the man-land ratio? Not percentage, but is it enough land to feed everybody, so to speak? Is that what you're thinking?
No, you just, they're just asking you to put those two into comparative contrast, right?
Way back when, there was a man-to-land ratio, and there would be, and what that meant was that there would be like one family. How much space did that family need in order to be able to have a, sustainable living?
And
maintain the family to be, healthy and thriving. And that was the ratio. And that's where it started.
Right. Yes. And I think everyone basically understands the dynamics of this. And when you have sophisticated sewer systems, you can have more people, in a smaller, space, and not have it be problematic. And it's a very complex thing. But the whole point is you have to think about it. And you got to figure out what's appropriate. Okay.
You are sometimes shocked at the ravages of war, but you should recognize the necessity for producing large numbers of mortals so as to afford ample opportunity for social and moral development. With such planetary fertility, there soon occurs the serious problem of overpopulation. Most of the inhabited worlds are small. Urantia is average, perhaps a trifle undersized. The optimum stabilization of national population enhances culture and prevents war. And it is a wise nation which knows when to cease growing.
Yeah, I mean, they're basically, you know, we've already, you know, gave you more things to think about with this. But just notice the one little challenge they put in the beginning there. It's like, oh, yeah, war, that's really bad. I got to avoid that at all costs. So we need to stop procreating. It's like, well, okay, so if you really back off on the procreation, recognize, but you should recognize the necessity of producing large numbers of mortals so as to afford ample opportunity for social and moral development. Right? If you cut back on procreation too much, you're not that person that you need that's really going to help in a certain situation is not going to be born. You know, not to mention, you know, if war does come upon you, you need cannon fodder. I mean, there's just some harsh facts here. Right? See, so they're just pointing out how easily, you know, in the name of your, spiritual enlightenment, and you're backing off on procreation because you don't want overpopulation. We've got enough people already. Well, what most likely that means is the very people that you need to progress civilization, you think progress is a very important thing, you call yourself a progressive or something, right? You're actually not going to have the people born that would foster the progression you desire. And your society is going to stagnate. I mean, this is not a trivial thing, right? That's another big problem with with unlimited abortion. What if the very person? What if that great musician that would have utterly transformed the entire world culture is aborted? That's the thing. You can always flip it around. See, it's like, well, we should just, because you could have another Hitler born, we should just not procreate and not risk it. See, that's, you can't let fear. You have to have the courage to procreate and deal with the unfortunate individuals that are procreated. You might want to also recognize that one of the things you're supposed to do is see to it that it becomes more and more impossible for a Hitler to ever be born, because you've eliminated all of the degenerate stock from mankind.
Is he degenerate stock?
Well, I mean, anyone who thinks in such cataclysmic ways is obviously has genetic problems, right?
Or they call it a screw loose.
Right? You know, just because you're extremely brilliant and whatnot doesn't mean that you have issues of relationship to the cosmos. See, again, we judge, it's like, well, he's a really brilliant person, so that's as best as you get. Yeah, that brilliant person, I can tell, has no relationship to the cosmos. It's not how brilliant they are, it's how ignorant they aren't. And just because he didn't become a Hitler doesn't mean in the end it's any more helpful. Right? They don't have the philosophic integrity to be a key to advancing civilization. You know, and the horrendous intellectual notions that person generates in many ways could be more destructive than Hitler ever was. I mean, how problematic was Karl Marx's thoughts? He wasn't Hitler, but slightly problematic intellectually.
Never picked up a gun,
caused many more deaths than Hitler ever caused. No, his ideas were the most primitive thoughts that mankind can have. Communism is the most primitive notion of civilization. See? Again, it's just, right, that, like the book tries to bring out. See, that's the thing. I mean, we don't think about this properly. And then because of it, we cause great pain amongst ourselves. Okay, let's see if we can get a little bit more here.
But the continent richest in natural deposits and the most advanced mechanical equipment will make little progress if the intelligence of its people is on the decline. Knowledge can be had by education, but wisdom, which is indispensable to true culture, can be secured only through experience and by men and women who are innately intelligent. Such a people are able to learn from experience. They may become truly wise.
And I was just talking about that. See, you have to have a philosophic nature, not just a fancy intellectual nature. Right? It has to, because the wisdom, the philosophic fact, not to mention insight, and relationship to truth and other things. I mean, those are indispensable to true culture, true fake culture, culture that has a resonance with the cosmos and hence will be upheld by the cosmos. So this is exactly what I was saying, if the intelligence of its people is on the decline, in part that can be from ever more problematic genetics. Mine's built on Swiss cheese. But also, you can choose this ignorance. Right? See, again, you know that by intelligence there, they don't just mean raw horsepower, of their second adjutant or something, right? Okay. Right, they mean human quality intelligence.
When this book was written, they didn't know that the education that everybody would be getting right now would be so degenerate.
They hadn't seen it, but they certainly knew it was coming. Right? They can predict our future way in advance. I mean, all the writing was on the wall at the beginning of the 20th century to what kind of a state we're in now. I'm sure they could predict the state we're in now based upon what was in existence 100 years ago to 10 decimal places. You can just notice it's like, wait a minute, that doesn't sound like something that's directed to the people at the beginning of the 20th century. That sounds like they knew exactly where we would be today.
They had to anticipate it. Look how much planning went into this thing arriving.
They anticipated the next 1,000 years when they wrote this book. Right? Let's just, it's really late, but let's just do this one last little chunk, number five.
Five, effectiveness of material resources. Much depends on the wisdom displayed in the utilization of natural resources, scientific knowledge, capital goods, and human potentials. The chief factor in human civilization was the force exerted by wise social masters. Primitive man had civilization literally thrust upon him by his superior contemporaries. Well-organized and superior minorities have largely ruled this world.
Yeah, we've pointed that out before. That Andite nature naturally ends up ruling. And all of the thousands of years of tension that's built up amongst those who were ruled, like we've talked about, and that bursts forth. The interesting little technical thing to note there, natural resources, scientific knowledge, capital goods, and human potentials. Oh, yeah, the four things we just read about. But wait a minute, the order's not the same. Why would they change the order? Why isn't it natural resources, capital goods, scientific knowledge, human potentials, like the order they just gave them in? They look a little bit there. They just put them in the order. See, you have two sets of two in what we just read. The first in each of those pairs is the immediate sort of thing issues, and then the second in each of those pairs is the relationship between of the beings to the things. See, and so you have the foundational thing one, and then the more advanced thing, and then you have the foundational beings related to things element, and then the more advanced one. Yeah, just notice little things like that. They're trying to teach you about the patterns that they're bestowing upon you here. Right? But yeah, you know, but again, that whole fact that there are superior and inferior in the quality of mind. Okay, and then one final little statement here.
Might does not make right, but might does make what is and what has been in history. Only recently has Urantia reached that point where society is willing to debate the ethics of might and right.
As we were kind of pointing out. But you
sounds dangerous.
Yeah, right. And obviously going to a lot of potential, right, for going off on false tangents, yes. But notice, okay, at the same time that they're bringing up this might and right issue again, they italicized force in that previous one. Right. If you go back to the italicized sentence about might and right, might does not make right, but it does enforce. See? So they're just picking that up by italicizing force here, and bringing it up again. But see, pointing out how there's a synthesis element here of those first four, and in that space, you can begin to reflect on exactly the proper ethics of might and right. You know, they're just pointing out that you need all of the complexity that they've done in the first four elements to have any hope of not going off on false tangents as you start to engage that difficult issue. Because you'll not appreciate the proper role of might and whatnot if you don't have the whole picture, including it organized, like they just reorganized the order to help you, right? Okay, so, see, that's why I wanted to do that one, because it kind of is a package then. All right, so we'll just keep chugging along on these next time and see if we can wrap up the paper. But, the touchy subjects that we touched upon tonight, I hope I challenged you enough already to, challenge the assumptions that people have handed to you. They tell you, oh, we know such and so. Do we really? Right? Don't be afraid to challenge those assumptions about overpopulation or whatever it might be. We need to make sure that we're doing the best job we can, and we aren't thinking that, well, someone figured that out a long time ago, and I'm sure it's still fine now. Well, they may have properly figured it out a long time ago, but it may not apply properly now anymore. It needs to be rethought. Okay. All right. Let's take a moment here, everyone.